Joseph.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Hey everybody, welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul, I have Simon Cornell, and we have David Wayne with us. Hi, David Wayne.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here.
I invited you to do this because I noticed you're one of our few followers on Instagram, and I'm like, oh crap, nobody's doing anything right now. Maybe I can bug him. So I really appreciate you taking the time during quarantine to chat with us.
And I appreciate you acknowledging me taking the time to follow you on Instagram.
We're all giving something here. Yeah. This is the latest in an increasing series of Nick bringing on someone I've never met and don't know. So this is great. The other listeners get to find out as I do. So David, what's your deal? Nice to meet you.
I mean, I know you just from seeing you on various videos about magic on the internet.
Which videos am I on?
I wish I could remember exactly, but I feel like I've seen you talking about things, demonstrating tricks, etc. Am I wrong? Tell me I'm wrong.
You're probably not wrong. I just don't really think about it much.
Yeah, that's because you're such a big celebrity. It doesn't cross your mind.
I think I just hate the internet as well.
We just did a live test on Simon's YouTube page, and I'm like, oh yeah, you need like 1,000 followers to do a live thing. I'm like, wait, you have like 2,000 followers. So we just did a test, and Simon's famous without knowing he's famous. So I think that's the best kind of famous.
What was weird, and that's literally because it was weird. I had 16 followers on YouTube, like met most people, and then the Penn and Teller clip went up, and it just jumped to like 1,200 in about Which is, and I considered, maybe I should now do this in quarantine, posting a video going, hey, hi, 1,000 people who follow me now. No judgment. Why? What would you like to see here? Is there anything that you're looking for? Maybe I could do that. And she's just asking them what's up.
Is there ever a time when there's paparazzi not outside your house at this point?
Only right now.
Okay, cool.
He does live by the Magic Castle, so it's paparazzi or premieres or homeless people looking in your window. So it's one of the three.
In like YouTube money, 2,000 followers is kind of, it's not nothing, but it's also chicken feed, right? In terms of actually being.
I'll grant you that.
World.
Close to nothing.
Yeah.
So, moving away from Simon Cornell's invisible famousness.
Yeah. David,
I'm a big fan of yours. Like I said, I appreciate you taking the time. And you're a castle member, I assume.
I am a Magic Castle member only the last couple of years.
Okay.
But it was always my dream as a kid when I was just for your audience's reference, I am not a magician by trade. I'm a hobbyist. But I have always been into it. And since I was 7 or 8 years old and I had my subscription to Genie magazine, I dreamed about being a Magic Castle member in Cleveland, Ohio, where I grew up. But I never really did it. And I finally, a couple of years ago, I auditioned and did the whole thing. And now I'm proud to say I'm a member.
Was Simon one of your people you auditioned for by any chance? Because he used to do that for a while.
Oh God, that might have been.
Oh, you know what it is? I think I might have met you. Now I'm remembering this. I met you and you gave me some tips because I flunked my first audition.
Oh, wow. Hang on.
And we sat there, I think maybe with a trailer or with someone else. And you gave me a few tips and then I came back and nailed it the next time.
You heard it here first. Simon Cornell.
Simon flunked David Wayne.
I didn't flunk him.
No. I don't think you were one of the judges at that time. I think.
Yeah, I remember that now. It was Ryan Traylor.
Yep.
This is the director. Yeah. Oh God, that's right. We have met.
Yep. Now I remember too. I'm sorry I forgot that until right now. Sorry, now I really majorly remember. Not only did I forget, I forgot you were instrumental in me having the confidence and the skill to become a member of the Magic Castle.
Wow.
I guess I'm sorry I brought that whole thing up.
This is an unexpected conflict. This is like one of those movies where it turns out that James Bond and Blofeld knew each other all along or something. but David, for the audience, what are you by trade?
I'm a writer, director, and producer, and sometime actor. in the comedy, TV, and film world, mostly.
And rather than, because the obvious question is, okay, what would people know you from? And I'm going to not ask that and instead ask, what are you most proud of in your body of work?
Well, you know, I'm of the mindset or the DNA where I'm truly largely most proud of what I've most recently been working on, because that's kind of what my current brain is about. And so the last few weeks I've been working on making dumb for fun covers of music videos on Instagram.
I got to say Smooth Operator has been in my head for 3 weeks. So thank you.
Glad to hear it. but I'm just going to answer your first question, even though you took it back, which is the work of mine that people would know best would probably be Wet Hot American Summer, Role Models, Children's Hospital, The State.
I am the opposite of Simon. I am a big, I'm going to try not to geek out too much. I'm a big fan of your work. And for me, Stella has greatly influenced, you know, my comedy style. Where did the three of you, I mean, I know it can kind of came from The State, but where did that goofy off kilter, I don't know, presence come from? Because it's just so absurd and it's just so wonderful to watch.
Thank you. Stella is a comedy trio. That's me, myself, Michael Ian Black, and Michael Showalter. And we were three of the 11 members of the sketch comedy group, The State, in the 90s. And then when the three of us got kind of interested in the growing, burgeoning alternative comedy scene in Manhattan at that time. And so we started performing in these little bars with other great comedians, and we decided we wanted to put together just an evening of comedy that was like a big old-fashioned night out with martinis and like dressing up and everything. And so we put on suits and we started hosting this weekly comedy show, and the shtick that we did between the three of us became kind of one of the coolest, the most exciting for us part of the show. And then we started making these little shorts just for fun the afternoon before each weekly show at the nightclub. And the shorts then took on a life of their own. And they in turn inspired a series. And then we started going on the road. And so the Stella trio started just becoming this weird thing that organically evolved over many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's just such a brilliant back and forth with everything on that. So it's one of my favorite things of all time.
Thank you.
My list.
I love it too.
Just got a lot longer.
Well, there's this set of shorts that you can find on the internet, which are truly just experiments in how distasteful can we be. And then there's a series we did on Comedy Central for one season, which has a different flavor, but is the same general idea. And the series is very tough to find in any version.
So moving back to magic, where did your fascination with magic kind of come from? You said back in Ohio, was there like a local magic shop or anything?
Yeah, there was. I mean, there was a lot of elements to it. There was definitely, I remember just the excitement of sitting with my parents and when a special would come on, like Doug Henning was a big one that I just absolutely loved. He had his annual or however often they were specials on network TV that I just remember going to see him live in Cleveland. And I remember seeing Harry Blackstone Jr. And I just loved magic as early as I could remember. I loved when somebody would come to the birthday party or, and then there was this one shop in Cleveland. And the guy who ran it was named Joe Leffler. And I eventually took lessons there from this other guy named Manny Sperling. And I just thinking about, you know, the whole world of magic in Cleveland was so, I don't know. I was just completely super into it. And, I ended up doing, you know, I printed up business cards and, when I was 12, I was doing shows at birthday parties, and I went to magic camp when I was 11, the Tannen's Magic Camp, and I was just very, very into it. And I remember my teacher at the time saying, you know, when you get to be 13, 14, you're going to drop it because you're going to be into girls, and they're not going to think it's cool. And I promise that will happen. I'm like, that's not going to happen, and it kind of did happen. But I never completely dropped it. I kept kind of doing card tricks and stuff. And then only in my 30s, I'm now 50, did I decide, in my mid-30s, I was like, I want to get really serious. I want to like really learn this stuff. And so I started just studying in a more adult, real way card stuff.
It's funny, a lot of people have that arc, really into it as a kid, drift away from it into some other successful creative career, then with some time and some resources, come back to it and reconnect with that passion. It's a really common pattern.
Yeah, I know. I've talked to Jason Sudeikis about that.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, it's definitely, I mean, as a busy parent and person working and stuff like that, to have a hobby that is so portable and so flexible where, you know, if I'm sitting waiting for a meeting to happen for 20 minutes, I can practice something and in a real way, you know, or just on a bus or whatever.
Do you know where it is about magic for you, particularly as it looking as a kid, we're all idiots. We don't know what we're doing or why we like anything, but as an adult, is there anything about it that you can put your finger on about why you're still drawn to it so much?
Well, I think I'm actually drawn to it for different reasons than I was as a kid. As a kid, I think I loved the idea of secrets and also the performative aspect of it, maybe. Now I feel like I love the puzzle part of it and the psychological part of it. But I love everything I do, and I love doing anything with my hands. I mean, that's everything I've done in my life, whether I love playing music and I got into the Rubik's Cube recently for a couple of years, and you know, and a lot of what I do in my professional work as a director is all just like looking at something and breaking it down, figuring out the puzzle, figuring out where the missing pieces are, how to fix it, how to change it, and ultimately, as a filmmaker, similarly as a magician, you're trying to then put all of the mechanics hidden and make it seem effortless and breezy, and I think that is something that I continually love in different forms. In fact, we were talking about these music cover videos I've been doing on Instagram, which are really just a bunch of different people in their different quarantines, each playing a song together. And then like, it's really fun and sloppy and fun. But behind the scenes, I'm actually putting so much more work into it than it looks like. And there's so much, you know, fixing and adjusting and making it so it feels easy, but it's not. And I think that's been a lot of the comedy and filmmaking I've done has been a similar tone where it feels kind of thrown off, but it's behind the scenes, it's the opposite.
Yeah. That's something I've been finding recently is an intense background in magic leaves one well-equipped to tackle almost any creative pursuit because you're familiar with enormous amounts of invisible work, so much more than anyone would ever imagine you'd put in.
Exactly. And I love that concept in magic of the real secret that the lay audience has trouble getting their head around of so many real great magic shows is that I just put in more work than you would imagine anyone would.
Yeah.
and that's what draws me so much to Derek Delgadio's show. So I just feel like that you get that strong sense that the only secret here is really that he thought about it and put more work into it than anybody would.
Do you see that in the same vein as comedy? Do you think there's more of like an instant release gratification, or is it the same amount of work putting into the jokes?
It's a very similar idea. Yeah, I think it's that when I'm writing a dumb joke or those things you see in Stella, the throne. I mean, sometimes there's moments where it is truly spontaneous and whatever just happens to be captured in a moment. That's its own. That happens too. But my style tends to veer towards this dumb dick joke has been poured over for months, you know.
And but it's the smartest dick joke you'll ever see.
Right. But I mean, yeah, it's stupidity that's been crafted and poured over and discussed and edited and thought through and then tweaked and redone.
Yeah. You know? There's so many different kind of layers once you peel it back with what you guys do and what you do in your, you know, various endeavors. And I feel like that's the similarity in magic in that, okay, you're seeing the surface, and then, you know, with what Delgadio is doing, you pull back the layers and go, oh, there is a lot more to this once you pay a little bit more attention. Which
right.
Is cool.
And I've always been jealous of, I mean, I don't think I've, you know, I don't think it's in the cards for me to ever be a professional at it, but I'm envious of the people who have the time and focus to go to that level as their day job. And I realized that, you know, and I remember that film Comedian was about that with comedy. Like you have to wake up in the morning and do it all day to get actually really good at it. Sure. And I feel like for a hobbyist, I'm pretty good. But for someone who does it, you know, some of my friends are like, my God, you're as good as anybody. You must be as good as anybody at the Magic Castle, whatever. I'm like, you guys, you have no clue. what it really looks like when someone actually puts in, you know, the hours and then the years.
I think that humility is so important, though. I mean, it's the same with comedy. You can't get good at comedy unless you know you have to put in your 10,000 hours. And yeah. I don't know. I've seen so many. I mean, I think Simon's one of those people too. He's so good at being
not funny.
Yeah. What's that?
No, I missed it. Too.
I thought you said not funny.
That is what I said. I was
okay.
Kidding.
Good. Just clarifying that Simon Cornell is not funny.
Superlative at being not funny.
No, I think there is something to that humility of knowing that this stuff takes a lot of work, whether that's comedy, music, or any form of variety art form.
Well, but I also feel like if you're a stated hobbyist, then, you know, you have the license to do whatever, you know, and that's what's nice too. There's no, sometimes I get really frustrated with trying to perfect something I'm working on in a magic thing. And then I step back and I'm like, oh, this is only for me anyway. So I can just pick it up next time. But I'm pretty careful to not perform even for a small group something unless I know I've got it good.
Hmm.
What's your personal threshold of how you know / feel that you've quote unquote got it good? When do you feel it's ready to try for a small group?
Well, the truth is it keeps changing because when I first got into the more serious level of it in my 30s, I picked up that, as so many people do, I guess, that there's that manipulation video by Ricky Jay that's on YouTube that is like this very involved spade production and then full deck in order of production at the end. And it's, I spent months, truly, a lot of time every day trying to just learn this very complicated thing, you know, kind of from scratch. So I had to learn all these different techniques and moves. And after a few months of it, I felt like I had this 2-minute thing down. And I did to some degree, but over the years, I've gotten better and better at this one thing. And 10 years in, I'm still not ready to show it. Yeah. Like, I actually made a video and put it on YouTube at one point, and then I took it down because I was like, no.
I've done that many times with not putting in enough work into something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, about that, where those lines are of good enough for you, good enough for an audience, good enough for the world. And they're all very subjective. And like you're not constantly shifting, I think, is healthy because it means you're constantly thinking and reevaluating and not just going, yep, this is how it works, done.
Definitely some of my favorite experiences, though, in magic in my adult life have been when I'm with, say, 5 people at a dinner and they're like, please do a trick. And then I am in the mind zone to do the jazz of knowing which thing will work for this audience and which way, and being able to manipulate attention in a way where I know that a very, very basic trick is going to blow these guys away in this way because this person I can tell is not looking over there, whatever, you know, that can be great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes, there's a time and a place for a sort of a 10-course Alinea degustation and a time and a place for a ham and cheese sandwich.
Exactly.
So something doesn't have to be elaborate and amazing for it to be the perfect thing for that situation.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I just remember this past year I did, a friend of mine was like, you're a magician, come do card tricks at my daughter's bat mitzvah. And I was like, oh, that seems like fine. And then as I was preparing for it, I'm like, wow, this is a big job. And basically they put me in a corner and people came up to me all night long for 5 hours and I was doing tricks. And my goal was to not repeat anything, which I didn't do. But there was some kids I realized who were just like, I'm not moving from here. I'm just going to sit. And so I really started digging into the archives. But it was fun. It was a very kind of exhilarating. And it was the prep for it that was the most fun. It was like getting so many things locked and loaded.
I love, by the way, that moment. That was me laughing, the great laugh of familiarity and relatability when you get those people at a gig who just decide, I'm going to watch you for all 3 hours.
Always. It's a good and bad thing because
it's so relatable. It's like, yes. We've
for strolling, you are literally just killing time if it's like an hourly gig because you're there forever. So when you have those people that show up and just want to keep seeing stuff, you're like, yes. Yeah. Then you run out of things to do. Oh, crap. Do you see any, how much of the, because you said you put something up and you took it down that was magic. Do you ever do that? How often are you doing that with, you know, editing what your short form comedy or television or movies? Are you constantly tweaking it, or is it just kind of once it's done, it's done?
Well, you know, obviously there's a thing when something goes on the air or gets released as a movie, that's, you're generally unable to change it after that. But
is it helpful to have that, okay, this is the date, this is a release? Yes. Are you constantly changing it up to that point? I guess that's the question I was asking.
Absolutely. And I think that there, in anything like that, in any filmmaking scenario, I feel like you have this moment where you're like, I feel like this is done. And then you sleep on it and you look at the next day and you're like, whoa, not even close, not even close. And that happens. You just know that's part of the process. But, and then I do find that when you finally let go, you know, I forget the quote, somebody that, you know, you don't finish a movie, you just let it go, you know?
Like, yeah,
you,
sure.
And, yeah, like art's never finished, just published.
Right, exactly. But I do go through a psychological change when something's released in a big way, which is like, I stop seeing the flaws. I'm just like, this is what it became. It has become the canon of whatever this thing is. And of course there's things I would do differently, but I don't look at it with that lens anymore. I just like, it is, that's that. Now on to next.
I love that Jon Stewart quote of, you know, the show isn't done at 4 o'clock. It's, you know, just when that's when it goes to air. That's when we have to tape it. And there's something kind of neat about, you know, just having a deadline and knowing, okay, I can't work on this anymore. I'm editing Rob Zabrecki's web series right now. And it's that same thing. I'm like, okay, I finished. This is hilarious. And I wake and I go back the next day and go, oh, this isn't good at all. So it's like, I can see until it's finally, I'm told it's done, it's never going to be complete.
Well, actually, one of the current projects I'm working on is a daily sitcom show where we're actually doing the daunting task of putting together a 22-minute narrative half hour every day.
Wow.
But to me, the experiment of it is the point. Like, we're designing a machine where it's like, you know, you don't, no time to overthink anything, you know, and it's like, whatever we got, when it's time to roll, we roll. And there is a liberation to that. It's kind of exciting. And then you're like, if something doesn't look great, then you're like, okay, we'll change it for tomorrow instead of worrying about yesterday. Yeah.
I think that's why I've kind of been envious of, you know, shows like Conan, where they can put it up and then the next day go, all right, well, we got to start all over and, you know, do it again. You can't be attached to any, like with, I think what we do, I am way too attached to my 45-minute show because I'm like, oh no, it's
right.
I can keep tweaking it. I can keep making it better. When in reality, it's like, no, it's, you got to let stuff go and you got to be done with it.
Well, right. I've always seen there's a happy medium, right? There's a balance. Both of those paths up the mountain can achieve great things as long as there is not too much adhesion to one ideology or the other.
Sure.
I completely agree. And by the way, I feel like I've worked a lot in the middle. Like a lot of the shows I've done in the recent past, like Children's Hospital and Medical Police even Wet Hot American Summer, were sort of like moving faster and with not enough money than I would like for this sort of thing, but making it work. Whereas this Daily Show I'm talking about is more like designed for exactly that. And I do agree that there's so much, I love the idea of saying, I'm taking as much time as I need to get this right. And then it'll release it when it's ready, you know? Mm-hmm. And I agree that both things have, and I do really, I have a great admiration for magicians, for example, who will, you know, have a routine or a 5-minute thing that they have done for decades that is just, it shows, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is something really profound about, again, having worked in both those modes, right? The improv quit, you know, improv being the extreme end of do it now with no prep versus the crafting a thing for years. And I think there's so much value in both approaches and indeed the hybrids of the two. And both are very fun, both are very worthwhile. And it's just good to have both kind of sets of tools in your toolkit of going, all right, how are we going to approach this? Which
one will there was a phase, I think, in comedy movie making where the spontaneous was starting to be valued too much in ratio to me versus thinking things through ahead of time, because the sort of improv-y quality became in vogue. And I think we lost track of, no, writing down a script has some merit in thinking it through.
Mm-hmm. Any particular examples you can point to of that phase from your point of view?
I mean, there's a great documentary that came out about Wet Hot American Summer that it seemed like it was kind of, I don't know, how stuck to the script were you guys for that, or how much of that was kind of, you know, improvising in real time with the small budget and whatnot?
Well, like we were talking about earlier, the Wet Hot American Summer is far more on the page than it looks. Hmm. I would say 95%. It was we were on such a small budget with one camera, and film was very expensive and moving very fast that we didn't have time to screw around. You know, when the camera was rolling, we had time to get the one thing we needed and maybe one or two takes and move on. And but you know, there were moments of invention and improv, but more than not, it was a script that we had worked on for years and had readings and rehearsals and really like, and then at the end, it looks like a kind of freewheeling, you know, silly
sure.
movie. But I think that's exactly that mode. I've done other things like there are parts of Role Models and Wanderlust in particular, these movies that were far more, parts that were far more improvised or letting the actors go in whatever direction. By the way, that you mentioned that documentary about the making of Wet Hot American Summer, I'm just going to announce that in the next week or so, it's going to go up on my website, davidwayne.com, for free, if anyone wants to see it.
Oh, cool. Hey. Yeah, it's great to watch. I went back and rewatched. I think I've watched the 10 years later and then the you guys did 10 years before and 10 years later. Is that correct?
We did the first day of camp and then 10 years later.
Yeah, both brilliant. And if anybody hasn't seen it, please go watch it.
This is on Netflix.
On the Netflix, yeah. And then Medical Police just came out not too long ago too, which is also hilarious. That's also on the Netflix too. So.
This is a comedy half-hour series about a worldwide pandemic. Check out.
Which this came, it dropped in January?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Pretty amazing. Yeah.
And I'm very proud of it too. You should check it out.
it's amazingly funny. It's absurd.
Damn.
Simon, I feel like I cut you off. Were you saying something?
Oh no, I forget. If it was important, it'll come back. I'll remember eventually.
I mean, we always ask people, you know, like in magic, like what's kind of a fun horror story that's happened on stage and how you had to manage it. Anything come to mind while shooting something or even live, you know, in the Stella days that happened and you had to react to it in real time?
Well, the first thing that came to mind actually before you finished asking the question was my first audition of at the Magic Castle. Because the way they set it up there is they don't tell you when you're going to go. You're like all waiting in the bar. So you can't even be alone and getting ready. You're sort of like with other people and then you don't know when they're going to call you. They make it hard. In fact, that's what you were telling me, Simon, is like that's on purpose and that I should practice with two sweaters on.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because by the time, that was great note, truly. Because by the time I got down there, I was so agitated and uncomfortable and nervous and sweating. And like within the judges got me off guard immediately because they were like, why don't you try this kind of trick? Like, and I had been planning this other thing. It was so awful. Like it was all me. I mean, I was just like a mess and shaking. And normally I'm like Mr. Cool.
Aren't we all, David? Aren't we all?
But, so that came to mind. But, you know, I mean, there's been horror stories all the time. What was the question again?
How have you navigated? I mean, I guess that's a great answer. The castle auditions are I auditioned with a man in like snake leather suit.
Yeah.
And
it's the most amazing place.
A couple, like just you see these people, you're like, this is this. And then the other people are just amazingly good. And I auditioned with a friend of mine that I knew from Florida. We walked up, we took the subway together. We auditioned and he was the only one who did not pass that day. And it was a very awkward ride home for him to have to leave and me stick around. And I felt so, so terrible.
The one thing I would clarify is that who knows what we said or what we heard. They don't deliberately make it hard. That's never been their goal. The difficulties that you've described are very much the result of they haven't thought enough about the whole process.
Right.
To realize maybe you shouldn't do it that way.
And also that after you finish your audition, they make you wait to find out what happened. Like that is just
it's very unintentionally brutal. That's very much Hanlon's razor of that's incompetence rather than malice.
Gotcha.
They don't mean that to be the way, and they're constantly working to improve and optimize and refine the audition process, which has a lot of problems to it in its current and past forms.
But unless I'm going to need to audition again, I don't care.
Fuck those people.
I've talked to people. I auditioned because I only moved to LA like 4 years ago, and it wasn't
welcome to town.
Terrible. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. You know, we're about to leave because all the magic gigs are gone. But it was okay. But every time I talk to somebody, it seems like it gets harder and harder by the month. It seems like they're not letting in as many people. It used to, like, I think I had 8 people audition and 7 of us made it in. I don't think that's always the case, but it does seem like it's getting more and more challenging to audition.
I think that certainly the place is becoming far more popular.
Sure.
And also, I know that they're trying to make it not so many white men.
Yeah, that's also part of the problem.
Although now it's closed, I wonder when it will open.
Yeah, let's hope it does. You're right. They have it absolutely is a policy. They have been slowly racking up the quality level threshold for the auditions because there were lots of issues for quite a while of just people passing who just really shouldn't have.
Sure.
And one of the issues of that is the official. There was never really a clear standards threshold of what should take to be an AMA Magic Castle magician member. That was never really explicitly laid out. And there's sort of these two ideologies of, is this a club for just anyone who's into magic? Like, is the threshold, can you functionally perform magic and therefore are quote unquote a magician, regardless of good magician, whatever?
Right.
Or should it be for people who really have something to offer? And it very much has fallen on the inclusivist side, which I am just glad it's not my choice, because that feels like a very tough call to make. Like both of those have a lot of merit to them. I can see pros and cons to both. But I think for a long time, it definitely fell way too far on the inclusivist side. They were just letting in kind of anyone who could just bumble their way through. But then
it's so interesting in a way how, like, it's fascinating to me. Like, it's just, you know, there's not a lot of examples I can think of a private club, which is essentially a social club, that has a skill-based requirement. You know, it's interesting, but I'm proud. One of the reasons I joined was because every day somebody would be like, "Oh, are you a member of the Magic Castle?" And I would be like, "I'm not, but I think I probably could be if I wanted to be." You know? But now I can just give a simple yes.
Yeah,
it's weird how in LA we get asked that question just constantly, but then you leave LA and nobody knows, you know, for the most part, what the Magic Castle is.
Although I think that's changing.
Yeah. I guess it's more so Californians. When I do cruise ships, it's people from California know and always ask me.
You might want to take a break from that.
Oh no, I got 3 coming up. I'm leaving next week. Yeah.
Weird. Okay.
They said it's fine.
David, the way you articulated that so beautifully, that the best thing was just to be able to navigate, have a more pleasant version of that conversation. That was almost entirely why I was really happy to actually get the fooling Penn and Teller judgment change. Because same thing. People go, "Oh, you're on Penn and Teller Fools. Did you fool them?" And I'm like, "Well, no, but that's not the point of the show. It doesn't really matter. Right. Like, that's not what it's about." And like, "Oh, yeah, sour grapes, cool." So now I can just go, "Yeah."
Yeah.
I did a year later.
Yeah.
It's a strange place. It's but it's I hope it opens. I hope everything is, you know, good when it does reopen. You know, I was supposed to be doing the Palace in a week and I'm not now. I was supposed to be doing it with Jill Ward and Stuart McLeod. It would have been a really fun show and I'm super bummed, but
you know, I know every aspect of entertainment, live entertainment, is in flux now, and you know, I'm sure there are, God willing, not that, you know, that there are many venues that probably will not reopen.
I'm cautiously optimistic, but I know it's not going to be an easy year because I was curious, because like in the 80s and the early 90s, you get the comedy boom of stand-up clubs. And now I was kind of wondering when the bubble was going to burst for all these magic clubs. And I feel like maybe this is what's going to tip it. I hope it's not, but I do feel like this could close up a whole bunch of them. And there, you know, a bunch of amazing venues out there. I was supposed to be in Nashville this week at House of Cards and nope.
Well, I think as with all things related to coronavirus, nobody really knows. I think we can pretty much bet that we'll come back to a world that's not the same as it was.
Yeah.
But how and in what way and how much, I don't think anyone knows yet.
No, if no. I can quote What Hot American Summer, day bidet.
Day bidet.
Which is just my favorite thing.
As opposed to your night bidet.
Right.
Simon, do you have any questions? I don't want to take too much more time of David's time.
You say that like I'd planned for this.
We do very little research on this podcast.
David, what are you...
I've already said everything I know.
Yeah. What are you... This is sort of like my go-to question, both in life and in sort of this existential podcast. What right now, creatively, personally, what are you most excited about and what are you most sort of annoyed slash worried about? I mean, obviously coronavirus aside.
Let's see, my own creative work?
Yeah.
I don't think coronavirus aside is possible to answer that question. And I would say, you know, I'm in a, you know, involuntary break right now, which is very much both of those things you asked. It's a blessing and it's given me space and impetus to think differently and outside the box about what I'm trying to do creatively and why. And that's exciting. And so I'm exploring sort of different areas of my creative brain and looking backwards and forwards in different ways. And then the obvious other answer of what's frustrating me is exactly the same, which is just so much unknown about what's to come or where the income's going to come or how the industry is going to exactly shake out from this and what happens next. So
what have you found yourself thinking about and or seeing differently creatively because
I had a lucky career where I've created a lot of things, but my kind of work schedule season to season has been project to project, and things kind of come up where, oh, that thing that I pitched is going to happen now this year, or I got a job doing this thing, or, you know, and it just sort of, something always comes up to keep me busy and working for the most part.
How do you manage that? Because that's kind of my biggest anxiety in doing, you know, magic full time is just, okay, project to project. And, you know, looking back at the calendars, like, oh, you've been working consistently for several years, but in reality, it seems like it's a month to month or sometimes week to week thing, as if something's actually going to get greenlit and happened. Is there any like way you manage that?
I have the same anxiety and I think about it all the time. I think managing a project-based career is a challenge, and you have to, you know, because you're not in control usually of so many of the factors as to when something's going to happen or how long it will take. There's other people and other companies involved. Excuse me. And so I don't have a great answer for it. I do try to think about, you know, prioritizing and managing and saying like, okay, I'm going to say no to this because I don't want to go insane, but I'm balancing with that I need to make a living and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't want to, you know, fall out of the loop. And I'm always asking those questions too. Is this basically my my real answer?
That's good. I mean, it's comforting to know it really is, because I mean, it seems like everybody I talk to with that kind of struggles with that, who does this sort of thing full time,
right?
And
especially, I know it's you. I can see you do many different elements of things. You do your podcast and all the things you do. And for me, it's the same thing. Whereas sometimes I'm envious of someone who is like purely an actor. Sure. And so you know, you have a schedule. Like either you're available for this day or you're not. You know.
Yeah.
Just fill that calendar. That's it. It's one step.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The same thing.
I'm even envious of my friends who have like real office jobs sometimes. And I know I'm very lucky and I'm, you know, very fortunate, but I do see them just have that, okay, this is their schedule for the week and they know they will be working.
Right.
There is something to that of just, you know, peace of mind for sure.
Yeah. But you know what? They're so bored.
That's true. And I hear about that constantly. So I try not to think about it too
much. I will say though, that as a, you know, as a freelance creative person, I do try to be in a situation where I go to an office every day if I'm working, you know, like whether it's for a project that I'm working on or in between. I used to have just an office, so that I had the routine of feeling like I'm a normal person that wakes up and sure. leaves the house and works and then stops working and comes home. And I aspire to try to do that more often. And of course, now quarantine has completely upended that. I have two kids.
Well, that's something that I've been thinking a lot about recently and have spoken to a couple of friends about, that in Drawing Room Deceptions, Guy Hollingworth's great magic book, which he wrote when he was a university student in the UK, he wrote about how when he wrote the book, he would get up in his tiny student dorm each day to write the book. He would get dressed into a suit and a tie and shine his shoes and like dress well, and then sit down at the desk and write. And then when he stopped writing, he would then stop and then change into a comfortable clothes and go about his life. And that psychological mindset of now I'm at work.
I absolutely love that. That is so, I mean, that's a bit extreme, I would say, but I think that is a big, you know, I think that whole fantasy of like, I'm going to sit in my PJs and, you know, work in my underwear. And it just doesn't, it's exactly the wrong idea for me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think we're all learning that. Like a lot of people who hadn't gotten into that mode are now figuring out, oh, I got to wake up and go to work every day on Zoom.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting seeing people kind of learn it and, you know, struggle with it, because it is so, I think, normal for people like us to go, all right, well, you have to set your own schedule. You have to, you have to get dressed up, or you have to go to this location to be in work mode. And I think a lot of people are learning that now, which is, you know, a good thing. I think more people have appreciation for those who work at home.
Yeah.
A lot think it's easy, and it's not. It's actually incredibly hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, there's, I mean, again, I'm constantly thinking daily about, again, being in the very lucky, privileged position to be, you know, like badly affected by this, but way less badly than most people.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm thinking a lot about the many in this otherwise horrible event, the many little silver linings. We're going to come back to a world which is much more connected, much more open to consuming online content, much more willing to pay for online content, much more knowing how to work from home, collaborate remotely. There's all these little kind of skills we're now learning as a civilization out of necessity that we sort of had before, but now it's going to permeate almost every level of society. And there's a lot of opportunities, I think, that opens up for us as a species.
I hope you're right.
Me too. I'm trying to be optimistic today.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And on that positive note,
it's been a pleasure, David. Good properly chat with you about the audition feedback.
It was a joy. Thank you so much, you guys.
Yeah, this has been a treat. Like I said, big fan, so really appreciate you taking the time. So I hope you're surviving with your family and, you know, staying healthy.
Everyone, stay safe. Lots of love.
Back at you. Guys.
All right.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Quarantine session done.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcast. If you really like the show, you can donate a few bucks a month on our website, twomagiciansonemike.com, or become a monthly subscriber through our Patreon link. Thanks to all the people that support the show and keep it up and running. Be sure to follow us on the interwebs at @twomagiciansonemike. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.